welcome into this special edition of the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Fowler. As part of the Between the Lines video series, we focus on a conversation between Brian Helfand, Chief of the Division of Urology, and the Ronald L. Ches Family and Richard Mellman Family Endowed Chair at North Shore University Health System, and Dr. Stephen Finkelstein, a radiation oncologist with Florida Cancer Affiliates U.S. Oncology Network in Panama City, Florida. These two experts talked about PET-CT guided post-prostatectomy salvage radiotherapy for prostate cancer, as well as really diving into the results and clinical implications of the EMPIRE 1 trial in prostate cancer.
Today's featured article is 18 fluorinated flucyclovine PET-CT imaging versus conventional imaging alone to guide post-prostatectomy salvage radiotherapy for prostate cancer, or the EMPIRE 1, a single center, open label, phase 2-3 randomized controlled trial. I'm Brian Helfand from North Shore University in Chicago, and I'm here with Stephen Finkelstein from the Florida Cancer Affiliated U.S. Oncology Network in Panama City, Florida. And so I think that this is one of the most important articles that people should be aware of, both for community and academic-based practices. I think most people who are watching this really understand that prostate cancer is a very complex disease, and many decisions that we make aren't perfect. And I think this is one technology that can help us with some decision making. So the background here is that non-metastatic or localized prostate cancer can be treated with definitive therapies, including surgery or radical prostatectomy or radiation. For those men who undergo either of these therapies, unfortunately, it's still cancer and the cancer can come back. And so many of these procedures, prostatectomy and or radiation, have inadequate treatment responses, if you will. Disease can return in 20 to 40% of patients. Again, some of this is based on the aggressiveness or Gleason score of the surgical specimen or tumor type, and is influenced by many other adverse pathologic features. But if you underwent surgery, certainly adjuvant, meaning immediate, or salvage, waiting until your PSA value starts to rise from zero, can be used to treat disease recurrence. And molecular imaging is one way to help guide us in these treatment decisions, because historically, we used conventional imaging in the form of CT scans and bone scans to try to locate where that disease recurrence was coming from. Unfortunately, many of these were inadequate, and even though it's still considered standard, CT and bone scan aren't that sensitive for picking up disease recurrence. And often we have to wait until PSA values go to as high as greater than 10 or greater than 20 before we can identify a target. Within recent years, flucyclovine, or a fluorinated PET-CT imaging agent, has been used that offers increased sensitivity and specificity for identifying disease recurrence after treating prostate cancer. Certainly the technology, the PET-CT imaging, has been FDA approved in the space of any type of failed therapy. This could be surgery, this could be radiation, or it could be men who have been on hormone therapy and whose disease continues to progress. Specifically, the article that we're going to talk about today are all men who underwent surgery and experienced a disease recurrence. And this technology, flucyclovine PET CT imaging, has really been used to help us identify or locate targets that can theoretically make subsequent radiation therapy more accurate and more improved. And we've all accepted this as a paradigm to say that if we can better localize it and we can treat it, then that should give better oncologic outcomes. However, which is true in many aspects of all urology and oncology these days, is even though we hypothesize something, we have to prove it. And the EMPIRE 1 study is just that study, which was the first one to attempt to answer that question of using PET CT imaging can influence oncologic outcomes. Stephen, I'll let you take that away.
So Empire One is a single center, open label, phase 2/3 randomized control trial. And let's think about that for a second. So when the study was conceived and designed in 2011, molecular imaging was really not being done with PET radiotracers routinely for prostate cancer. Indeed, when we think about radiotracers, if you looked prior to 2011, there were really no trials that were randomized in the context of post-prostatectomy that had tested if an agent could improve upon cancer outcomes. And so in their eligibility was patients with prostate cancer. They needed to have a detectable PSA after prostatectomy, and they had to have negative conventional imaging, which meant no extra pelvic or bone findings. And of those, there were 165 patients. There were 165 patients, and they were randomized in a one-to-one fashion. As you can see by the orange bar, they were randomized as patients to get radiotherapy directed by conventional imaging alone, which is the way that we had currently been doing radiotherapy, versus what was seen here in the gray bar, which is radiotherapy directed by conventional imaging plus fluciclovine F18 PET CT scan. And the primary endpoint was 3-year event-free survival. And events included either a biochemical or clinical or progression or initiation of systemic therapy. So Brian, we've just looked at the Empire One trial schema. What are your thoughts about this particular trial?
So I really like this trial. And, I think just in the actual design of the trial, and certainly when it was engineered, Emory was and continues to be, the site where the fluciclovine PET CT imaging was really born. And so it's a single center, so we acknowledge that, and I'm not sure that we could get beyond that. But we have to understand that Emory itself may be superior in its interpretation of all of the images because, again, these are radiologists who have been working with this imaging from the start. Certainly, we have seen in looking at the trials that have all been based for fluciclovine an improvement over time. I think even at baseline, when radiologists are first trained, they do a great job. But I think there certainly is a learning curve. And I think Emory certainly has been well through its learning curve. So we just have to understand that and interpretation of the results. What do you think, looking at the study design, is that as they randomized patients and patients had a recurrence, many of them were actually on hormone therapy for various amounts of time, and some of them had, various types of hormone therapy prior to enrollment in the study. Do you think that that's common? And certainly back then, it wasn't standardized of how we were giving the hormone.
So that's a very good point about androgen deprivation. Androgen deprivation is being used more commonly than previously in the setting of post-prostatectomy radiation therapy as results of randomized trial data. Additionally, the RTOG 0534 trial, which is a randomized trial showing significant incremental improvements going from prostate bed radiotherapy only to prostate bed radiotherapy plus short-term androgen deprivation, to prostate bed plus pelvic lymph node radiotherapy plus short-term androgen deprivation could be used to justify both androgen deprivation and pelvic nodal radiotherapy for a higher proportion of patients, particularly patients with PSA concentrations that were higher than 0.34 or greater. When we think about the clinical trials, the failure-free survival rates in RTOG 0534, there were higher than those reported herein, with a 3-year failure free survival that approximated 80% in the study group. And as we see, as we go to the next slides, you'll see what the actual Kaplan-Meier data was with respect to Empire One.
So this is really the crux of the paper. And this was how men did in each arm of the group. And so this is a Kaplan-Meier curve that demonstrates the probability of patients in each group experiencing event-free survival. So the bars would lower if patients experience a disease progression or recurrence or PSA increase throughout the study period. And as you can see here, the red bar is the flucyclovine, the study group, which again got radiotherapy planned based on conventional imaging plus flucyclovine findings versus conventional imaging alone shown in the blue bars. And as you can see here, at over 3 years follow-up, the conventional imaging had more events, so more men in those groups experienced disease progression throughout the study period. This was statistically significant and associated with a 1.84 hazard ratio, meaning that men in the conventional imaging group were 1.84-fold higher likelihood of an experiencing a result throughout the study period compared to men in the flucyclovine group, suggesting that the flucyclovine group offered additional oncologic control that the conventional imaging group did not experience.
So when we explore the univariate analysis, variables that were significant predictors of event-free survival were a PSA of greater than or equal to 1, the absence of extracapsular extension, the absence of seminal vesicle invasion, a Gleason score of 8 or higher, and whole pelvis radiotherapy. Now, indeed, other variables assessed were not found to be significant predictors of event-free survival, and they included such as age, race, margin positivity, nodal positivity, the use of androgen deprivation therapy, and study group. So, Brian, we've just gone through the univariate analysis. What do you think about these variables?
I think that these are very stereotypical, meaning that most studies that have looked at adverse outcomes, whether recurrence, whether progression to cancer-specific mortality, these are generally the variables that we're looking at, meaning that once PSAs get elevated, when we have adverse pathologic features, including pathologic T3 or greater, when we have high-grade, high-risk Gleason grade group 4 or higher, we are going to see a higher risk of having adverse features. Again, many of these are predictable. However, I think when we look at these in a multivariable way, it helps answer the question and helps us stratify and identify if the treatment group, flucyclovine or not, impacted outcome.
And I think that's key. So I think we really are interested in the multivariate analysis, which I think we have on the next slide.
So this is the results of the multivariable analysis. So when we took all of those significant factors or variables on the univariate, and we put this all into a statistical model, again, that adjusts for all of these other variables, we do see that the event-free survival was significantly higher risk in the conventional imaging group compared with the flucyclovine group. This is not unexpected based on the other results, but really emphasizes that the hazard ratio, once we adjust for all the variables and correct for this, was 2.04. So that means that men in the conventional imaging group were over two-fold higher risk of having an event over the study period, which again was only a 3.5-year follow-up. Again, the median survival event-free was not reached in either group, again, which was not necessarily surprising given the fact of the short follow-up in terms of prostate cancer treatment. That's not unexpected. Are you surprised by any of these results, or you know, what do you think about that, about 12% difference between groups?
Well, I think it's quite remarkable. I think again we have to phrase this in the mindset of most imaging modalities are not approved for improvement in demonstrating cancer outcomes. So this is the first time that we're using a PET radiotracer for prostate cancer, specifically in the setting of post-prostatectomy salvage. And there are more events in the conventional imaging group. And that's actually with some less patients that were actually in the intention to treat. And when we look at 3-year event-free survival, there's a 12% improvement in event-free survival at 3 years, the primary study endpoint. Again, this is using a PET tracer to guide final radiotherapy treatment decisions and target volume design. So, you know, I'm very excited seeing this data. And, you know, the next thing I'm starting to think about is, so you're improving cancer outcomes. What about the toxicity issues?
And I think we see that in the next slide.
So when we look at failure-free survival and adverse events, again, the median follow-up for this particular trial of Empire One was about 3.5 years. As we see on the left side of the slide, the failure-free survival at 4 years was 51% in the conventional imaging group versus 75.5% in the fluciclovine PET-CT group. Again, from our previous slide, we know there's a 12% improvement, as Brian said, in event-free survival at 3 years, which was the primary endpoint. Now, all of this doesn't really matter if there's real tremendous differences in toxicity. When we think about adverse events, the most common adverse events were actually very limited, with late urinary frequency or urgency, 46% of patients in the conventional imaging group and 41% in the PET group. Again, these were any grade events. With respect to acute diarrhea, it was 14% in the conventional image group, 21% in the PET group. The key points is when you look at significant adverse events, i.e. greater than grade three toxicity events were infrequent, and there were no grade 4 or 5 toxic effects. So you have a study which is demonstrating that there's a 12% improvement in event-free survival at 3 years with really no changes in toxicity by changing the radiation therapy fields based on these imaging findings.
And so really in conclusion, and I think you summed that up very nicely, is that fluciclovine PET imaging really has the ability, and this is the first study to prospectively evaluate this, to change our management and improve overall oncologic outcomes over at least a 3.5 year period without adding additional toxicities. And as such, this, you know, should be, you know, kind of considered, because not only can it help us locate where disease may be, but certainly not only that location can help and influence our treatment decisions, which has previously been evaluated in other trials, including the LOCATE trial. But now we know, according to this paper, that it actually can improve our overall outcomes. So I'm very excited by this and look forward to continuing to talk about this.
We'll start by talking about what are some of the key takeaways from this paper. Brian, do you want to start us off?
Sure. So just to remind everyone, the results of this paper were the Empire trial was performed at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, when fluciclovine PET CT imaging was really first coming into play. And so they had the foresight to see if the results of fluciclovine imaging added any additional value to further oncologic control, meaning that if we plan our subsequent radiotherapy for men who have had biochemical progression or progression after radical prostatectomy, did fluciclovine influence that treatment plan, and did that treatment plan actually influence outcomes? And what the paper ultimately showed was that, yes, it did. At 3.5 years follow-up, there was an absolute difference of about 12% of men, which is significantly greater. And in multivariable analysis, that was a twofold higher hazard ratio or likelihood that men who underwent flucyclovine were less likely to experience a disease progression at, following salvage or adjuvant radiotherapy. And importantly, is that this additional oncologic control, which was guided by the flucyclovine, did not offer or provide additional toxicities, meaning that men who underwent radiotherapy based on flucyclovine versus men who underwent radiotherapy based on conventional imaging did not experience increased urinary or bowel issues or other toxicities, suggesting that we got improved oncologic control, but didn't have worsened issues, toxicities, following flucyclovine imaging. So this was great. And so I think that that is really the takeaway point. And I think, Stephen, as you previously pointed out, that there are very few, if any, imaging modalities that have led to improved oncologic control, such as PET-CT imaging.
Yeah, so I think as we talk about some of the interesting questions, we have to think about the context of which the study was initiated. So at the time, at about, say, 2011, when this trial was initiated, the conventional way we approached trying to find prostate cancer when we felt that there was a recurrence was with technetium-99 bone scans. Now, technetium-99 bone scans were not approved because they could improve cancer outcome. They were approved for use based on the ability to detect disease. As most imaging agents are approved for a improvement in sensitivity, specificity, and ultimately maybe positive predictive value, negative predictive value. But this was in a unique trial which this agent had suggested an improved diagnostic accuracy against standard imaging, and that was again bone scan, CT, or MRI. And the investigators had the intestinal fortitude to structure a trial to try to improve upon cancer control outcome in the context of post-prostatectomy, rising PSA, could they change the radiation therapy fields? So we could talk a little bit about how radiation therapy is delivered in the post-prostatectomy salvage setting. So in this setting of where people are doing conventional imaging, the patients who were going to get radiation and conventional imaging was really determined by the individual investigators, whether patients got radiotherapy to the prostate bed or radiation therapy was going to be delivered to the prostate bed and to the pelvis, or radiation therapy was not to be delivered at all, right? In that world that we live in, that's based on conventional imaging. In this trial, in Empire One, for the first time, they had an algorithmic approach based on the PET imaging. And so if there was extrapelvic or skeletal uptake, so i.e. disease outside of what would have been a normal radiation therapy field, no radiotherapy was given to the patients in this trial. And they were excluded from the intention to treat analysis. If there was pelvic nodal uptake seen, then radiotherapy was delivered to the pelvis in doses that we would standardly give. That's between 45 and 50.4 gray and 1.8 gray fractions. Plus, they would get radiotherapy to the prostate bed in the typical doses of 64.8 to 70.2 gray in 1.8 gray fractions. Now, if there was uptake in the prostate bed alone, then you would radiate the prostate bed alone. And that would be to, again, the 64.8 to 70.2 gray. What if there was no uptake? Well, you would still do radiotherapy in this trial. You would radiate the prostate bed. So it's interesting to see that if you did not find uptake, which is pretty much what we classically do, we would radiate the prostate bed alone. So an algorithmic approach based on PET as the determining factor of what was to be treated. Brian, what do you think about that as with respect to a radiation approach?
I actually think it's brilliant. I certainly, having lived through the years and talked to many radiation oncologists who I consider close colleagues and friends, a lot of times it was kind of an overall gestalt. I think we should do this, and hey, we're going to try and justify it in some way. I think once we have a true system in place to really stratify patients and then understand where that disease may be coming from, I think has really kind of changed the field. And again, here we see in a prospective fashion that it does influence the way that we can, our outcomes, at least a 12% advantage. I think that that's huge and very, very exciting. You know, I think ultimately in the same spirit is that, as you said, is that this is came out and developed in the year 2011. And again, I think that that was very advanced for the time. And in that this short decade since, we now have improved our understanding of flucyclovine. And I think radiologists' experience has also improved. And I think now we have even newer and some FDA approved technologies, PSMA PET imaging. And so I think if those are more sensitive, we still don't know, and how they react or influence, we're still unveiling. But I think that will also add to this algorithm. Would you agree?
I would. I think those are all excellent points. One of the things that I occasionally hear is, well, you know, you're potentially expanding the areas that were radiated. And is that a bad thing? Is that going to lead to increased toxicity? So first, let's take a look at, did we actually expand the volumes that we would have been treating? So in the conventional group in this trial, 56 patients of the 81 got prostate bed radiation alone, and 25 got radiation to the bed plus an additional field to the pelvic nodes. What about the PET CT group? Only 41 patients of the 80 patients who were in the study group received prostate bed alone. 35 patients got radiation to the prostate bed and to the additional pelvic field. So there was a larger radiation field delivered in this group of patients when you think about the 80 patients. But did they have more toxicity? So when we think about the toxicity analysis, you look at the significant grade 3 or higher AEs, and there was no difference between the toxicity between the conventional group and the PET group, even though the fields were larger. So this was extremely well tolerated. And so for those who may say, well, you know, you don't want to do more radiation because more radiation is going to be more toxic. Well, this group was PET driven radiation. It was larger fields in many patients, but the toxicity was not significantly higher. And with that, from a urology standpoint, is that something you think that urologists will really say, well, I'm excited about the fact we can deliver, targeted, PET targeted radiotherapy and keep the toxicity about the same?
I mean, I think that's important. I hope you're not offended, but, you know, sometimes urologists have this impression that we live in a silo and a lot of the subsequent events are just not necessarily recognized by the radiation oncologists. But I think, you know, sometimes when we actually study and document it, it becomes very important. And I do think that this is something that we can expand our fields, continue that collaboration, and have that patients come back and not worry that we're giving them increased risk where I'm going to be irrigating their bladder out or sending them to GI for some type of coiling or control of their proctitis. This is very, very exciting for us, again, because we can do all this without the toxicity, but improved oncologic control. One of the things and questions for you to comment on that I think I always get is, well, in the absence of a positive flucyclovine scan, and we can't figure out where it's coming from because the disease is presumably so small, why do we radiate anything? Or should we just wait until the PSA is higher and we can identify a target? I think I have my own answers for this, but I think it's just important to verbalize because I do get from a lot of urologists and oncologists the question of why don't we just wait?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And to that, I always bring up, for many of you who are watching this, they say, well, Willie Sutton is a famous bank robber. And they said, well, Willie, why did you rob banks? He said, that's where the money is. And classically, when we did not know where a potential cancer recurrence was, we radiated where we thought the money was. And if you radiate the prostate bed in somewhere between 40 and 70% of the cases, you'll never have another problem from prostate cancer. That's pretty good. But the question is, can you improve upon that? If only about half the time you're right, could you use something to determine what was actually the places you needed to be radiating? And so nationally, I've talked about this for the last decade. As we developed next generation imaging, whether it was C11 or Auximin scans or now PSMA, the idea to actually find the targets and then radiate them is much more appealing than just, you know, I'm going to radiate where potentially the money is, because we're only right about half the time. Now, as a surgeon who became a radiation oncologist, I was very attracted to the idea of next generation imaging guiding this. And this trial, Empire One, for the first time uses a PET agent in a randomized fashion to actually determine these things. Now, it does have its downsides. Again, as you stated before, it's a single institution paper done at the place that really developed the PET agent. So their acumen is obviously extremely high. Does this translate to the same kind of effects in the community? We really need to test that. In addition, there are other pieces of information, you know, the use of androgen deprivation, the use of, you know, this kind of approach in a community setting will translate into the same kind of improvements with the same kind of toxicity outcomes. We really don't know. But again, a lot of exciting things we can learn from this paper and try to think about employing this in our practices.
Agree. And what would you say about the types of radiotherapy employed here, or, you know, some of the newer, more stereotaxic guided therapies? Is there a difference? Have we improved there? Is that going to offer potentially yet even more improved oncologic outcomes?
I think that's great questions for next steps. I think that this has been a very algorithmic classic approach, but the question is, could we have gotten away with, if you did not find the actual disease in the pelvis, could you not radiate those patients and wait, like you said? We don't know. But with the new next generation imaging agents coming down the pike, I could see the next 10 years developing approaches where we start to stratify these things. But for the first time, we actually can use a PET imaging agent, a next generation agent, and have an improvement using radiation therapy to improve oncologic outcomes.
Agreed. And very, very exciting. And again, I think, you know, even from the medical oncology perspective, an androgen deprivation therapy, it becomes even more exciting and complex with newer androgen deprivation agents, androgen receptor inhibitors, et cetera, combined therapies to really stratify who needs it, who doesn't, and potentially some of that decision is going to be based upon the findings from many of these next generation imaging scans, whether it's Auximin, the flucyclovine as shown here, or whether it's PSMA or a combination. So I think that there are many exciting questions that continue to be that continue to arise, but will need to be addressed over the next upcoming years.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or you can listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast is the official podcast of Cancer Network, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at Cancer Network without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at Cancer Network. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we hope to see you back here next time.